I'm going to talk about G factors and quantum dots, and this various parts of this work were done with Michael Flatte, Joseph Pinchnot, and Emma Day at University of Iowa. I'll talk a little bit about bulk G factors because they're important for understanding what happens in the dots. And I'll talk about self-assembled quantum dots, and also nanowhisker dots, and also modulation by electric fields and G-tensor modulation resonance. The first part can be found in the paper listed below, the part on nanowhiskers and G-tensor modulation is not yet written up. So it's a good idea to go back to the free electron and remember what G-factors really come from. G factors come from quantum corrections to the magnetic moment of the particle. From the Dirac equation, the magnetic moment is determined to be this with G equals to 2. But in QED, quantum corrections to the coupling of an electron with a photon give us that G has these small corrections. And this is QED, but in a solid, essentially the same thing happens, where instead of the Feynman diagram corresponding to this Feynman diagram giving you, say a photon going across here, as it does in QED, what you instead have is transitions essentially involving going to other bands. And it's the coupling of the photon, or the magnetic field, a zero frequency photon, with these other bands that are giving rise to quantum corrections that give a different magnetic moment. And this something that you have to calculate will depend on the band structure, and in a solid it's always going to be something negative, less than 2, as opposed to in QED where it's actually a small positive correction. So the first place one sees G-factors is in introductory quantum mechanics books, where you look at the G-factor for an atom, an electron in an atom. And when you consider the orbital and spin angular momentum of the electron and have some small amount of spin-orbit coupling, just enough that you can that they combine to form a total angular momentum object, you compute the energy of the atom in a background magnetic field and use that to compute what the effective magnetic moment of the atom is, and right out of Schiff you get this expression. Well, this is for atoms, and it was found out a very long time ago, but it's important for solids because the block functions are atomic-like wave functions. And so the first thing you would think of in a solid is actually that the block functions are going to each have a different G factor, depending on whether you're conduction, valence band, split off band, all the rest. For the conduction band, the G factor is just 2. It acts like a bare electron. But for the valence bands, due to this this mixture of orbital and spin angular momentum, it shifts.
That's the G factor, not for a hole, right, but for an electron.
An electron in the valence band. Yes. Well, for bulk semiconductors, this is all worked out a very long time ago. That diagram of the fluctuation for the quantum correction to the interaction of the zero frequency photon with the electron is given by this expression down here. It's a second order perturbation theory result. And the intermediate states that you're summing over are different band states, different excited states away from the conduction band. This is the expression for the conduction band. It's all starting from the standard Hamiltonian, but we're assuming in as this calculation was originally done, k.p theory, that the wave, the true wave function looks like plane waves multiplied by some block functions. And carrying out the second order perturbation theory calculation, you get this nice simple expression for the shift in the g factor of the conduction band electron. And it depends on the E sub p, the momentum matrix element between valence band and conduction band states, the block states. Of course, that comes about because we're taking momentum matrix elements back here. And then everything else just depends on the energy gaps between the various bands, because that's the other thing going into the expressions. And it's a matter of just, very, very simple calculation. You notice, though, that this always gives g less than 2. And as the gap and or the spin orbit, or the gap gets large, very large, this factor goes to 0, and you just get back the original bare electron g factor of 2. This works very, very well for bulk semiconductors. This is a plot showing the lines are these calculated values, and all the dots are various experimental values, and it works very, very well. And we get very large and negative G factors for a lot of materials. And for a good period of time, people have looked at these bulk properties and said, oh, we can, in various kinds of devices, get very large G factors. And in many kinds of nanostructures, you can. However, in dots, it turns out that that's not quite the case. So to start looking at what the G factor in a dot would look like, we'll consider a prototypical dot, everybody's favorite quantum dot, the indium arsenide, gallium arsenide strain quantum dot. Now, because of the strain from the lattice mismatch, band structure changes quite a lot. The red dots are the original unstrained band energies. This is distance along the dot going along the 001 direction. And the dark lines are computed including strain effects, and it's just assuming you have an electron at some point in the structure with energy, a band structure corresponding to a bulk material having whatever strain you have in the location. So this is kind of a cartoon model. The gap shifts, all the bands shift around, and so the simplest thing you might imagine doing is just taking the new gap that's changed due to the strain and just plugging it into this Roth formula for bulk materials, and doing the same with the spin orbit splitting, which is also changed by strain. And for unstrained indium arsenide with this very large negative G factor, taking the strained values of these bulk properties and just plugging them into the Roth formula, you get a G factor that's significantly closer to zero, but still pretty large and negative. If you also, instead of taking just the band-to-band energy difference as the gap, but included real confinement energy for what the electronic state would be in this quantum dot, then you'd have a slightly larger gap that pushes this factor down even more, and the G factor you get is driven even closer to zero. You detect a trend. Well, this is by any measure a toy model, because we're not really including the confinement in the full detail. And so what we really need to do is do a full electronic calculation. And so the method we're going to use is method that's been used a lot for computing quantum dot states. compute strain, use 8-band K.P theory, where you have a 8-component wave function, and the Hamiltonian is then this 8x8 matrix that has all these differential operators in it and functions of the strain tensor multiplied by various deformation potentials. And then we just put this on a grid where all the differential operators become finite differences on the grid, and then solve it as a sparse matrix problem. Now, this has been used for a long time now to compute a lot of different quantum dot properties, and it works quite well. However, for G factors, we have to worry about magnetic field. And magnetic fields do complicate things somewhat. So we have to worry about how we're going to couple in the magnetic field. And the first thing we have to worry about is the coupling to the envelope. Now, the multi-component wave function psi is really the amplitude for various block functions. So it's the coefficients in the sum over block functions that gives us the real wave function. And when we have this low energy effective theory that describes how the envelope changes throughout the structure, the best way to couple this is to use the methods that are used in lattice gauge theory, in which the difference between wave functions at different sites is multiplied by the phase, the Aharonov-Bohm phase, from parallel transport from one site to another. So this UXR is the phase acquired in hopping in the plus x direction from the site located at R. U daggered x R minus x. So you start at the site R minus x hat, and then hop going the x direction. But we're hopping backwards since this is at minus x. So there's a dagger there. And when this quantity is multiplied by a psi at R, the whole thing is gauge invariant. And the whole reason Wilson in the early 70s developed lattice gauge theory was to have a formulation on a lattice in which you have absolute gauge invariance. Now, in terms of the continuum theory that we're accustomed to looking at, this doesn't exactly reproduce it. The U's have in them e to the I vector potentials dot vectors, and if you expand them out, expand those exponentials out, you get A terms, but you get A squared, A cubed, so on terms. But they vanish as lattice spacing goes to zero. So in the continuum limit, you get back the usual continuum results. But the really important thing is to have on the lattice a true gauge invariance so that you don't have to worry about violating that. Now, to determine what these U's are for a given applied magnetic field, what we have to do is take a product of the U's around a plaquette. So this is just hopping in a little square, starting at the site at R, just hopping around in a square. And that product of those has to equal the Aharonov-Bohm phase you would get for hopping around that little square. So given a magnetic field, you can determine these U's up to some gauge transformation. But the gauge doesn't matter. We can just pick any gauge we want. Now, all that describes the coupling to the envelope. We still have the coupling to the block function to worry about. And for that, we have a simple Pauli term, where there's a different G factor for each of the different bands. 2 for the conduction band, where it looks like a bare electron, and for the valence band, 4/3, and the spin orbit band, 2/3. And those are the two couplings to our magnetic field. So we use this, direct diagonalization method, and see what kinds of G factors we get by computing the spin splitting in a background magnetic field and seeing what G factor that corresponds to. Well, first case we want to consider is just a simple indium arsenide spherical dot, so that we don't have strain and all these other complications to worry about. And we also put in an unnaturally high barrier, 10 electron volts, so that it's essentially infinite. And the G factor is plotted as a function of the gap, so the point down here corresponds to the bulk, or an infinite dot, and the dotted line shows the this Roth formula for the bulk, using putting in different values of the gap for the dot. The solid line shows what you calculate from actually computing the real energy, splitting for the spin down in the background magnetic field. Yes.
But one S level coupled with one P level. It is not coupled with one S level.
I don't understand what you're
saying. If you consider coupling, the narrow gap converter, one S level and spherical control, coupled with orbital
state, Venus
branch
shape, angular momentum one. Mm-hmm.
So effective energy gap is not 1s, 1s.
Well, it, I mean, in a bulk limit, it would be. So, and since this is abusing a bulk formula, that's the justification for it. Although the gap used here is the real gap from the real 8-band calculation.
So,
yeah. So in both cases, as the confinement goes up, the G factor does get driven towards the bare electron value. The important difference, though, is that there's a very substantial quantitative difference in how quickly G factor is driven towards 2. In the full 8-band calculation, it's much, much faster. So what's going on? The qualitative way of we think of looking at this is to think about the Landau levels in the bulk and what happens to those Landau levels when you add confinement, because confinement is going to spoil the Landau levels. In a bulk material, the continuum of states, if you just turn on the magnetic field but ignore the spin and have your Landau levels, you still have a continuum of states. Even though you have discrete levels, and there is a continuum of states available. And so that if you have some additional perturbation, there's a whole continuum of states out of which to build your perturbed state. When you add in the spin and spin split all of these Landau levels, the spin preferentially aligns parallel to the magnetic field. And then so at this point it's all very simple. But as soon as you turn on the spin orbit coupling, things get a little more complicated, because now you've got a perturbation, and the perturbed states that you'd get from including the spin orbit coupling are going to have all of these continuum of states available from the Landau levels out of which to build your states. However, the spin orbit coupling wants to orient the spin in the opposite direction to what you had for just bare spin in the magnetic field. Namely, because the spin orbit coupling is proportional to dv/dr, it will align the spin preferentially anti-parallel to the orbital angular momentum of the Landau levels. So this is orienting the spin in the opposite direction. And so when you include that into an effective G and try to absorb it all into a magnetic moment for a single particle, you get a G factor that's less than 2. But it can go arbitrarily far below 2. And this is very different. This is all because the spin orbit coupling term is positive. If you could dream up some system in which you could get a different sign, then it would work out differently. This is very analogous to something even older than G factors in bulk materials, namely the theory of magnetic impurities, Van Vleck. And in that case, putting a magnetic impurity in a crystal, a magnetic impurity that initially has some G factor in vacuum, putting that atom in a crystal lattice splits the angular momentum states of the atom and quenches the angular momentum, thereby reducing the mixing of the, it's not quite a continuum, but at least you had a lot of states nearby in the atom out of which to make some state with a particular angular momentum leading to the G factor. But with the crystal field splitting, the mixing of these different angular momentum states is suppressed, and therefore you just see the bare electron. In a semiconductor, this mixing of the states, the continuum of states in the Landau levels to produce a state of a particular angular momentum will be suppressed if you add in confinement, because you won't have a continuum of Landau levels anymore. You'll have discrete atom-like quantum dot states. And so the mixing won't be available, and you expect to be driven towards the bare electron G factor. So we now want to look at self-assembled dots. And self-assembled dots are so variable in their properties that we really need to look at a lot of the range of different sizes and shapes you can get. And best way to parameterize it is the height of the dot and the elongation. They tend to be elongated, and so it can be typically elongated along the 110 direction. And so you take this ratio of the length of the base along 110 to 11 bar O. And then, so those two parameters determine the shape, and then there's still an overall scale. We can scale it up or down, changing the volume. And so this is G factor versus band gap, where the band gap is just a proxy for the overall size of the dot. Dots being scaled up and down. And the different colors and symbols correspond to different elongations along the dot and different heights. But as you can see, it doesn't really make much difference. It's basically the overall volume of the dot, and the gap that determines what the G factor is going to be. And up here, you see some experimental points pretty close. But there are uncertainties in self-assembled dots. You never know quite exactly what is being measured. There are compositional problems. There's just so many uncertainties that kind of a discrepancy is not too bad.
Yeah. Is there an overall minus sign here or something?
No, these are positive. This is the magnetic fields applied along the growth direction. And these are positive, yes. So the confinement is sufficiently strong that the G factor has been driven up towards 2 and
all. Why is it going then down with increasing?
Right. So why does it look exactly the opposite from the spherical one?
Yeah.
Yes. The reason is that as we go to very very small dots, large confinement energy, eventually squeeze the wave function out into the aluminum arsenide, gallium arsenide barrier. So it's different than that spherical test case. A spherical dot's a great test case to see the simple physics, but when you get in a real dot, the barrier makes a difference.
Yeah.
For a wire, you probably expect that to be a lot less because while the confinement energy is going to be less, you'd still always have a bound state. In this case, you eventually squeeze the electron out anyway. And so it has to go to the gallium arsenide bulk G factor. And you can also look at in-plane G factors. And you can pick any direction you like and look at whole G factors. There's a lot of structure, a lot of dependence on all the different geometries, which I won't show. But the tricky part is, with these at least, is always going to be that self-assembled dots, while they're a lot of fun for theorists because there are lots of things to do with them and lots of variables, that also means it's really, really hard to compare with experiment. And that agreement with experiment is, I'm not unhappy about it, but it's not as good as one would like. So there are other systems where one might hope to get a little better handle on these problems. And these are whisker dots. These calculations were done by Amrot D. at University of Iowa. And the calculations are for whisker dots that were grown on the Samuelson group in Lund. And the idea is they grow a nano whisker of 50 nanometers or so in diameter, but change the composition while they're growing it so that they get a quantum well structure along the whisker. They then can take one of these things. They break them off the growth substrate, lay them down somewhere, make contacts to them, and then they can do transport through it in a magnetic field and look at the spin split states inside this dot. Now the structure is very, very well controlled. They have quantum well monolayer type growth control where they can really lay down all the individual layers and know exactly how thick everything is. The outline of the whisker, the cross section of the whisker, is also very consistent. They're hexagonal, they have a very narrow dispersion in the diameter. So it's a very well-controlled system where you have a handle on what it is. There are a couple problems, though. The biggest one is that because of the growth conditions, they actually grow in wurtzite. And wurtzite material parameters aren't really known for these kinds of systems. So you have to at least for the moment, just settle for using zinc blend type material parameters. We're actually working on getting some wurtzite parameters from some calculations. But for the moment, we just have to stick with zinc blend. Now, the one thing we might worry about in comparing with experiment is that when these nano whiskers are laid down on substrate and they're contacted, the orientation, the azimuthal orientation, is completely random. And so they've got this nice hexagonal cross section. You might worry that how they're laid down makes a big difference. And so you want to check that the G factor for a magnetic field perpendicular to the axis of the wire doesn't really matter. And sure enough, as a function of the angle of the magnetic field with respect to the axis of the wire, its G factor barely changes at all. So we don't have to worry about that. That's good. So the, in Lund, they've measured lots and lots of these things. And the red points are measured G factors for different whiskers with different widths for the indium arsenide well. They're all have a diameter of 53 nanometers. And the blue curves are the what you'd expect for the Roth formula. Now, I should back up. The barriers are different for different whiskers, ranging from about 2 nanometers up to 12 nanometers. So there's these experimental points actually correspond to a range of barrier thicknesses. But computing confined energies in these kinds of structures using the Roth formula, the range of G factors you get are all way up here. Now, this is absolute value of G. The G factors are measured using a transport, so the only thing you get is the spin splitting. You don't get get the direction of the spin. You don't know, therefore, whether the spin is oriented parallel or anti-parallel to B, so you don't know the sign of G. However, it's a fair bet that it's that large. It must be negative. The dotted lines are from the 8-band K.P calculations, and so you're doing a lot better than the Roth formula. In fact, you've even got some overlap. Well, we look at the geometries in a little more detail and look at which one of these experimental points corresponds to which barrier thickness. See, things are not quite on target. For a 6 nanometer thick barrier, which are these blue ones, you know, a little bit off. The calculations are not within the error bars of the experiment. And I think most of this is probably attributable to this Wurtzite zinc blend problem. Although, there's one additional complication in some of these structures, and that has to do with the coupling to the leads. Now, for a very thin barrier, take this 3.5 nanometer barrier, there's enough coupling to the lead that the state in the dot isn't really a bound state. It's metastable. And if you look at the transmission for a transport calculation through through the wire, there's a 6 MeV width for that state. And the calculations are done actually raising up the gap in the leads so that we have a stationary state to calculate a G factor for. And for the thick barriers, that's not so much of a problem. The width of the resonance is so narrow, it's probably not a concern. But for thinner barriers, it probably does matter, although fixing it with a full transport calculation would be quite difficult. However, we have done some tests of seeing how much we can change the this artificially raised band gap in the leads and see how much a G factor changes up until the point where the wave function starts leaking out and you start calculating the G factor in the lead instead of the confined dot. So in this wave function, we have the electron completely confined to the dot, and then as we lower the barriers in the lead, you start getting some leakage out, and it's on the order of over the range we can look at, it's on the order of 10% change in G factor, 10-20%. So not real bad. So I think the whisker dots are great because of the clean geometry and composition, and we have a much better chance of getting a very accurate comparison between experiment and theory. But there's no question that it does much, much better than the Roth formula, and you can really see that there's pretty good agreement. The coupling to the leads is an issue, and Wurzite is also still an issue. Now, I want to talk a little bit about electrical control, because just having a spin in a dot by itself isn't very interesting. You really like to do something with it. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about some calculations done by Joseph Pinchnot, in which he's calculated the effects on the G factor from applied electric fields. So we see here some self-assembled dot, and the G factor for fields, magnetic fields applied along these two directions as a function of the applied electric field. And as the electric field, the electric field in all of these is along the growth direction. As the electric field moves the electron up and down in the dot, that's going to change the nature of the confined state, change also the material with which the electron wave function overlaps, and change the G factor. But the details matter, and for example, for a magnetic field applied along the growth direction for this one particular dot, there's practically no change at all. For the magnetic field in the transverse direction, somewhat larger change. The whole point in doing this is to do G tensor modulation resonance, in which one would like to have an effective magnetic field that's changed with applied electric field. So the usual vector form of the Pauli interaction is, in fact, with a G, in the presence of a G factor, is really this tensor equation involving the G tensor and the magnetic field and the spin. And by lumping together the G tensor with the static applied magnetic field, this whole thing becomes this omega. And if we can change the G factor with an applied electric field very quickly, then we can change this omega very quickly, which is like having a very rapidly controllable electric field, magnetic field. So this has been done in quantum wells here, Cato et al. It's now pretty well known. But this is done in quantum wells, and so it's done on an ensemble of electrons. The change in G factor in this case can be completely understood in terms of the electron moving through different materials and the electron having a different G factor in the different bulk materials. And because in a quantum well there's a continuum of states from the motion parallel to the well, the bulk description of the G factor is perfectly okay. But in a dot, it's going to be entirely different. The simple sampling of different bulk materials by the wave function is not going to be an adequate description. So we want to consider the electric field always pointing along the growth direction, but B possibly in different directions. And since we're worried about self-assembled dots, different heights and elongations and sizes to worry about. So the magnetic fields considered are growth direction and 110 and 11 borrow. Those directions chosen to line up with the direction in which dots tend to be elongated. And these are some calculations for B oriented along 110. as a function of the gap, where the gap here corresponds to varying the size of the base of the dot, but keeping the height fixed. So over here we've got very large dots, very small dots, and the different colors correspond to different elongations of the base. And the different lines within the colors just correspond to different applied electric fields. So the range of applied electric fields gives you an idea of how much you can change the G factor. For a circular base, over this range of gaps, at plus or minus 100 kV per centimeter, G will always be positive. But there are ranges for the dots that are elongated for which you can go from having a positive G factor to a negative one. Well, I'd like to have a very large range of, you want a very large delta G over G. Yeah. So, So bigger delta G over G is the better, wider, more control you have. And there's a fair range in here where for an elongated dot you can do it. And the most dots that people grow really do fall in this range of about E equals 1 1/4, maybe a little larger. So looks like the right range. In contrast, if the magnetic field's oriented along 001, things are kind of dull. And another one of these plots where every possible geometry and situations more or less on top of each other. So you have to be careful about what to pick out and what to try to do, because some things probably work and some won't. For the 001 direction, if you imagine having a circular dot, then you still have azimuthal rotational symmetry. So it still looks a lot like the original situation. You're not changing things much by moving the electron up and down. Whereas when you move the electron up and down, if you're looking at the magnetic field oriented along this direction, you move the electron up and down, you are changing the sort of the cross section of the wave function by a lot. So that's the hand wavy version.
But in additional experiment, the magnetic field was tilted from the.
In which experiment?
In the original Kapoor experiment, using the magnetic field was tilted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's. Oh, you mean, but not in plane.
Not parallel to 001.
No, we've only done parallel and perpendicular. Yeah. It's right. It's sort of a tensor, but it's a trivial tensor. So actually, this is enough. Yeah. Yeah. These are all static calculations. So the frequency dependence would, the frequency dependence would enter in probably it should depend on the ratio of h bar omega to the spacing between the dot states. So it probably would be suppressed over what you would expect in bulk or in a well structure, because the dot, the confinement energy is going to push up, push up the states, and the it'll be suppressed. But
what would be approximately maximum frequency that you can modulate this electric field?
You mean what's practical experimentally, or?
I don't know, from your calculation, I don't know what is the status of that experiment. People do this high frequency modulation of
I believe they do on the order of gigahertz. Yeah, I think it's more like gigahertz.
Yeah. Well, that's all extremely small. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very small. Yeah. Yeah, because these spacings are tens or hundreds of MeV. So static approximation should be very, very good.
Is it possible to use it, or someone demonstrate that you generate electrons converse masses by
Yeah, I think you could. Well, not on dots, I don't believe. Yeah. Yeah, so it's been done in bulk and quantum wells, but not dots. And the main reason is that experimentally, the signal's smaller for dots, so it's much, much harder to do. Well, it's a really, really hard experiment to do. I mean, so the signal is so small that it would be very, very challenging. But I think eventually it has to be done. If you're going to manipulate single spins, I mean, it's fine to do test cases on quantum wells, but for single spins, you eventually have to have single spins with dots. And these signals are small, and that's one of the problems. Yeah, I guess so. Well, we haven't. It could. Yeah.
When you say integral, it's just a matter of the signal. The mechanism you propose will, I would argue, certainly work.
Oh yes, yes, yeah. I'm just trying to explain why there's,
Did you estimate this effective magnetic electric field length of flipping of electron spins at those?
Joseph?
Because in order to flip, you need to have effective length.
Well, there were some estimates, and it was, a few nanoseconds? Yeah. But the estimates were, they're very crude estimates, so.
Field looking at the delta G's. So it looks like their delta G's are about point. So for something like gallium arsenide, sort of like a 10 Tesla field, you can have a changing field of 1 Tesla. So it's pretty large. Any questions? All right, let's see.